You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Public Affairs Director for the Democracy Fund, former senior aide to Harry Reid, Adam Gentleson, author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Meanwhile, for the first time in history, the House impeaches a president for the second time. It's also looking increasingly likely that a Senate conviction could come before Biden's inauguration. This, as more evidence builds, that there was significant planning and possibly aid given to the insurrectionists by Republican lawmakers. In other harrowing news, 4,400 COVID deaths yesterday, setting a new record in this country. Biden reportedly will seek a bipartisan deal, claims he wants to avoid reconciliation to pass a major COVID relief bill. The Supreme Court fires its first shot since Amy Coney Barrett joined it in its renewed assault on Roe v. Wade. Biden to name Gary Gensler as the SEC chair, to many cheers of progressive critics of banks. Less so, Samantha Power to USAID. And the former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and others now indicted on criminal charges for the Flint water poisoning. The U.S. federal government executes its first woman in 70 years, the 11th execution performed since Trump removed the moratorium in July of this year. And in India, their court suspends the implementation of a widely protested set of farm laws. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, obviously, a very historic day coming after, I guess we are now a week out from. It's sort of shocking to think that that was only a week ago from a historic and very disturbing attack on the Capitol. Joining me, as always today, Emma Vigeland. And Emma, one of the things that we are hearing more and more each day is there is increasing evidence that there was planning for this assault on the Capitol building, and that planning was aided by Republican lawmakers. This is a combination of video evidence that's emerging, of evidence that I guess allegations made by Democratic lawmakers, and sort of, I guess, circumstantial evidence that we will talk about, including Ayanna Pressley's office. When they barricaded in that office, the panic buttons had been ripped out of the office.
Right. They don't know when that happened or how it did. But again, we're piecing all of these things together, as you said. And the FBI was made aware of the potential violence in these protests. The insurrectionists posting on the internet about how they were going in there as warriors and to take lives, potentially contradicting the FBI's public claims. I mean, shocking that the intelligence community might lie to the public.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible they're lying and possible they're just like sort of bureaucratic mess ups. I mean, they are, but I imagine there's a certain amount of CYA. I mean, the clearly what happened is all up and down the chain of security. At the very least, there was just a sense of like, oh, these are just white Trump supporters, essentially.
Right.
They're not going to do any harm to anybody. Whereas, of course, the reaction to something like BLM protests or other types of protests are far more militarized, if you will, and security minded. Now, with that said, there are something like 10,000 National Guards members who are essentially deploying to Washington, D.C. People have seen the images of National Guardsmen sleeping in the Capitol building, getting rest, because they're going to be on duty now for days leading up to the inauguration. There is considerable concern that there could be other attacks, either in Washington, D.C. or other state capitals around the country. And, you know, we're waiting to hear on that. Meanwhile, as we speak at 12:09 p.m. In the Capitol, we are en route to a vote to impeach the president. And there are reportedly close to a half dozen right now Republican congresspeople who will be voting with the Democrats to impeach Donald Trump. There could be more. There is already pushback against Liz Cheney, who has been the most vocal member of the Republican caucus to want to impeach Trump. Now, of course, what we're seeing, of course, is a bunch of politics. There are Republicans who are deciding, many of them who, if they were already considered to be never Trumpers, this is their opportunity to sort of distance themselves from a party which gave birth to Donald Trump, which constructed an entire political project that essentially made it impossible for anybody within a Republican primary to beat Donald Trump. And so this is part of their political calculation. And I think it's really important that people are aware that even, and there's reportedly, and I think I saw a headline from the New York Times. Privately, Mitch McConnell is happy with the impeachment. Now, my definition of privately involves it not being a headline in the New York Times. In other words, if you and I, Emma, and the folks at home know that Mitch McConnell privately is happy that there's an impeachment, I've got news for everybody. He wants it to be known publicly. And this is part of his project to distance the Republican Party and himself from Donald Trump. It is very important that people maintain two thoughts in their mind. One, that it's good if we can get a conviction in the Senate of Donald Trump before Joe Biden gets in office, and some credit or at least acknowledgement that Mitch McConnell, needs to be involved in that process. And if it happens, has some responsibility and credit for that. But also be aware that, come on, this is politics, and Mitch McConnell, I don't know if there's a single person in the country who has been more enabling to Donald Trump than Mitch McConnell, starting back in October of 2016, when he said to Barack Obama, if you announce that there's interference by the Russians in this election, I'm going to make you pay a political price for it.
Well, I don't think there's one person more evil than Trump in this country than Mitch McConnell, if we're going to be real. McConnell's just smarter about it and more calculated. I mean, there's a number of things that could result from him clearly strategically leaking this to the New York Times. It's basically a trial balloon. He's trying to see how the public, how the press react. But there is clearly value in the Republicans distancing themselves from Trump at this point, because his approval ratings have tanked by 10 points in 7 days since the attack on the Capitol. Rightfully so. I think it's, according to Politico, their lowest approval rating, around 34%, that they have recorded for Trump. He's always been kind of in the high 30s, low 40s. At the start, people were giving him a chance, maybe towards the 50-50 range, but this really tanked it. And he was already tanking after he lost, because he wouldn't give it up. So he's toxic. He's radioactive at this point.
He's
for them
toxic
politically.
And I agree with you. I think Mitch McConnell is out there, and he is trying to get a sense of just how dangerous it will be for his caucus members, perhaps some of them anyways, to vote, and I mean politically dangerous, to vote for a conviction in the Senate. And if he is trying to set up a test balloon to find out if he should, I imagine, in his mind, to assess whether he should bring the Senate back over the next couple of days, which he could do. And we will talk to Adam Gentleson about that very question in a moment or two. To bring back the Senate and have a vote to convict Donald Trump in the Senate. In the meantime, here is another story. And again, this is part of a theme. The idea that Democrats would allow and provide the vehicle for Republicans to be excused in this moment is, to me, just bad politics. Let's play this clip. This is a Democratic House member, Jason Crow, a Democrat from Colorado, essentially letting Republicans off the hook. Even if we are taking this at face value, we know the enormous amount of death threats that Congress people like AOC or Ilhan Omar get on a daily basis. And yet, and I have never heard of any charge that they are not doing something because of that,
right,
short of walking around in public.
Yeah.
B, the idea that a Republican would come out and say, even express sympathy. We know the hostility that Republicans have shown to them. Here's Jason Crow doing the work of Republicans here.
We heard earlier, Arnold Lee and Caldwell reporting that you guys are going to send over this article of impeachment immediately to the United States Senate once it's passed, perhaps seeing if they can trigger action even sooner. But I want to give you a chance to respond to the process argument you heard from Tom Cole there, saying that this is all being rushed. Obviously, time is of the essence. Are you concerned at all about some of the arguments that Congressman Cole was making?
No, I'm not. I think we have to be honest about what it is we're actually dealing with here. First of all, there's a number of things that are happening on the Republican side. A very small handful, I think, are kind of morally bankrupt individuals who have given in to these conspiracy theories and are too far gone to be redeemed. But the majority of them are actually paralyzed with fear. You know, I had a lot of conversations with my Republican colleagues last night, and a couple of them broke down in tears talking to me and saying that they are afraid for their lives if they vote for this impeachment. My response was not to be unsympathetic, but welcome to the club. That's leadership. Our country is in a very challenging time. Many of us have felt that way for a long time because we've stood up for our democracy, and we expect them to do the same. But the process argument, we have a domestic terror threat that's being led and incited by the president. There are three substantial plots against the Capitol, against members of Congress. They're ongoing now in the weeks ahead, and against the inauguration and the president. We have to do what's necessary to protect the American people.
Okay, so now And to Crow's credit, at the very least, he was not so gentle with his Republican colleagues, and not so gentle in presenting it to them. But this is the functional equivalent of, you know, Chris Coons going on there and saying, well, you know, in secret, a lot of the Republicans think that Joe Biden won the election. When you talk about moral bankruptcy, you don't need to be a leader. I'm sorry. It doesn't necessarily involve you being a leader to do what is right. That is what the definition of moral bankruptcy is. When you are afraid to simply do what is at hand. There are other Republicans who are doing this. If enough Republicans vote, the idea that they're all going to be subject to being assassinated when this is, you know, we have literally just witnessed their people, essentially, their voters, their party members crash the Capitol, and those folks were looking for Democratic congresspeople. And so,
Mike Pence, I guess. The comparison to Ilhan Omar and Ocasio-Cortez is so important because they do get regular death threats way, way more than these Republican lawmakers will ever get or dream of. And that doesn't stop them from legislative and electoral bravery on a consistent basis. But what's so funny about that is that, yes, they get death threats all the time. And now they're upset that the Frankenstein, the monster that they've created, which is this MAGA obsessive base of supporters that don't believe in anything except for what Trump says, they're upset that that will be turned on them. They were fine with it being turned on the progressive women in the House of color. That's okay with them, and them getting death threats on a quotidian regular basis, that's fine. But now that it affects them, okay, they have something to say about it. Cry behind the scenes to Democrats who then make that case for them.
Right.
In public.
I'm sorry. That's just not going to cut it. Nope. You got to do the right thing. And we're going to talk to Adam Gentleson about that dynamic in the Senate in just a moment. First, today's program sponsored by Grove Collaborative. This is the way that I make sure I get all of my cleaning supplies without the hassle. If you are looking for high quality, natural, non-toxic cleaners, sustainability, Grove Collaborative is the place to go. It's an online marketplace, and you get things like soap and like sponges and like bathroom cleaners, and I get little vegetable brushes. My big thing now is what I get from them is, and I people know this, I don't like scents. I get the seventh generation. I get the dish liquid and the hand soap. No fragrance, completely fragrance free. I also, I get the Method bathroom cleaner stuff, antibacterial, all this stuff, non-toxic. That's what I like about it. I don't want my kids. I don't want the cats to get around this stuff. And the big thing that I did, particularly during the early days of COVID, is I bought like a bunch of refills. And they have dispensers. They have glass spray bottles. They have glass hand wash bottles. I went the whole hog on that. And so now I have like four or five of these bags, and I just refill it. It's super easy. And I have the app. And so for me, I just go on the app. You can go to grove.co. It's grove.co. You can join 2 million households who have trusted Grove Collaborative to make their homes healthier. Shipping is fast and free on your first order. You can also use their app. It's super easy. And that's the thing I think I really like about it. I like to go in, whatever it is, once a month.
You don't have to worry about it.
I don't worry about it. I don't think about it. Boom, I do a quick. You can make your home healthier and happier this new year for a limited time when you go to grove.co/majority. You receive a free Mrs. Meyers gift set plus some free shipping with your first order. That's a $30 value, but you have to use the special code. Go to Grove, grove.co/majority to get this exclusive offer. That's grove.co/majority. My little secret is that when there was a run on toilet paper, Grove had it, all the natural toilet paper.
Wow.
Yep. I probably should have told more people, but I was a little afraid.
Well, no, you were being protective.
All right. I want to welcome to the program the public affairs director from Democracy Fund, former senior aide to Senator Harry Reid, the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of the of American Democracy. Adam Gentleson, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, Adam, I'm obviously I'm very excited to have you here, in particular on, you know, on this day. And to some extent, you know, I think what we anticipated when we booked you has changed just a little bit. I want to talk about the filibuster and what you've written in the book and the history of the filibuster. It's fascinating. There was stuff in there, as much as I've been sort of decrying the filibuster for years, there was stuff in there I did not quite realize, and I found it a great read. And then obviously I want to talk about the report today that Joe Biden is going to supposedly eschew a reconciliation and try and get a bipartisan deal. But let's talk about this history of the filibuster. You basically break it down into two different eras. The first essentially coming from more or less around Reconstruction through to the Civil Rights Act. And give us a little bit of history of this. What I found amazing that I found from your book was that every deployment of the filibuster during that time, that some 80 years, I guess it was, more, was to stop civil rights legislation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we know, you know, we have a vague sense the filibuster was associated with segregation, with efforts to stop civil rights. You know, President Obama has called it a relic of the Jim Crow era. But, you know, that's not just an association. That was its primary and exclusive purpose. It was, you know, dating back to the beginning of the Senate, the filibuster was not part of the original Senate. The founders did not include it in the Senate. The Senate was a majority rule body and obstruction was looked down upon in the original Senate. And it was only after the intervention of John Calhoun in the middle of the 19th century that the filibuster really began to come into existence as we know it today. But it wasn't until the 20th century that the filibuster could be applied in the way we know it today, where it is used to raise the threshold to pass a bill from a simple majority to a supermajority. And the way it became honed in this method was by being used to block every civil rights bill that came before Congress from the end of Reconstruction in 1877 all the way through 1964, when Lyndon Johnson finally broke a Southern filibuster. So this wasn't incidental to the filibuster. This was how it was used. This was how Southern senators brought it into existence, and it became a normal part of Senate life, because civil rights and the continued oppression of Black Americans was the only issue that provided enough motivation for senators to make this massive innovation and change the shape of the Senate.
I mean, this is, you know, that was, and I want you to just talk a little bit about John Calhoun, because I think, you know, we've some time ago, I guess now it was, we had Nancy McLean on to talk about Democracy and Change, which covers a lot about John Calhoun. But give us a sense of who this guy was and the context in which, because your book is The Crippling of American Democracy. And on some level, it was pretty lame. It was a certain, you know, there was a lameness to the democracy as it, you know, when it started, particularly when we're talking about the Senate, right? I mean, this is a democratic body.
That's right. I mean, the Senate has always been an anti-democratic body. But I think the thing about that is that that's often used to overlook the fact that it was more democratic in its original conception than what it has become today. Even as a very deeply anti-democratic body, it was never supposed to be as anti-democratic as it is today. And John Calhoun was the originator of the trend that brought us to where we are today. James Madison, who's often cited as sort of the leading protector of minority rights among the founding fathers, never intended the Senate to have a filibuster, and he certainly never intended the Senate to have a supermajority threshold that almost every bill had to clear. The person who wanted it to be that way was John Calhoun. And so Calhoun was in the Senate starting in the 1830s. This was around the time Madison passed away. All of the other framers were dead. And Calhoun started to innovate the filibuster. He used it exclusively to advance the interest of slavery and to protect the planter class, who were his main benefactors as a senator from South Carolina. So he created the Senate where a minority could have a veto over everything the majority wanted to do. And he was explicit about this. He wrote a tract called A Disquisition on Government that was published right after he died. And he said that he didn't think the framers put in enough protections, and Calhoun wanted any minority faction in the country to be able to exercise veto over anything that passed. So the Senate basically for 200 years was caught in a battle between the Madisonian vision, where there was a lot of debate, but eventually a majority would have its way, and the Calhounian vision, where a minority could block anything that passed. It took about 200 years, but part of what the book argues is that Calhoun won. The Senate we see today, McConnell's Senate, is a Senate where a minority of 41 senators who can represent as little as 11% of the population can exercise veto power and block anything the majority wants to do. That is the culmination of John Calhoun's vision of the Senate.
We should be clear here that when we talk about a minority, particularly in the context of Calhoun, but really, I mean, until this day, the minority that we're talking about in blocking these things is really, I mean, the functionally the aristocracy, or at least the moneyed elite in this country, right? I mean, it's the moneyed, it's the powerful, it's those people who, the few who are ruling the many. And it is, and the idea of extending, I guess, American democracy to non-white people was sort of like the tip of the spear, as it were, in terms of like opening up and democratizing our country.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we should be careful with our terminology here. When I say minority, I'm talking about minority in the sense of the top 1%. This is not about protecting vulnerable racial or ethnic minorities. You know, Calhoun, the great American historian Richard Hofstadter, called Calhoun the Marx of the master class. So Calhoun only deployed minority protections to protect the overdog, not the underdog. And what he saw was that this minority was losing out. You know, he was operating at a time when it was becoming increasingly obvious that America wanted to move away from slavery. They weren't, you know, incredibly enlightened, but the Northern economic model was proving dominant. Even, you know, in the antebellum times, there was a prevailing sense that slavery was a necessary evil. A lot of the argument that they made was that slavery was bad for white people because it debased them and taught them bad habits. So, you know, we're not exactly talking, you know, enlightened thought here, but nonetheless, slavery was losing out and the slaveholding class was a minority. Calhoun needed to find a way to increase the protections and the power of the minority within our system of government. And in order to protect, you know, the planter class, the elite, the wealthy, and preserve the oppression of Black Americans, that is why he invented the filibuster.
So let's talk about, the second era, I guess, of the filibuster, where sort of the that game that you just described on some level, that dynamic is sort of blown apart by the Civil Rights Act. And we move into sort of like phase two of trying to maintain that power by the elite, essentially, in a new era. Characterize that era for us.
Yeah, so this is fascinating. So, you know, much has been written about 1964 when Lyndon Johnson, as president, finally broke a Southern filibuster against civil rights. Now, to be clear, this was not the first time a civil rights bill had come before Congress. There were many civil rights bills that had come before Congress, like we talked about in the previous 80 years. This was the first time that they were finally able to break a Southern filibuster. Now, at the time, people thought maybe this is the end of the filibuster. Maybe the way that people saw it being used against civil rights will cause it to go away. Its association with segregation, its association with white supremacy will make it something senators don't want to use. But what happened against expectations was the opposite. It lost its association with segregation. It became sanitized and sort of entered the market like a generic drug. And when it entered the market, it found that demand was high because senators saw how powerful it had been against civil rights. And, you know, their issue might have been something else. It wasn't blocking civil rights. It was, you know, agriculture policy. But they knew that they could take the filibuster and wield it and create leverage for themselves in the same way the South had used it against civil rights. At the same time, a bunch of unintentional reforms started to make it much easier to use the filibuster. Before 1964, you had to use the filibuster in sort of the Jimmy Stewart style. You had to go to the floor. You had to actually physically be there, speak. You often coordinated with a bunch of other senators, you know, and you could hold and you could block, you could hold the floor and block a bill for as long as you had the stamina to actually be there and talk, you know. And this still had some connection to the Senate, the idea of debate, you know, of trying to make your case, you know, still some connection to the idea of the Senate. After the 60s, a bunch of innovations happened. I won't get too deep in the weeds about what they are, but basically they gave every senator the power to wage a filibuster, to raise the threshold for passing a bill from a majority to a supermajority by sending an email or making a phone call before the days of email. All they had to do was signal to the cloakroom and signal to the majority leader that they were going to wage a filibuster against a bill. And the Senate's workload was growing so much by this point, the rise, you know, the expansion of the federal government caused the Senate to have a lot more to do, that the majority leaders, if they were warned that there was going to be a filibuster, they wouldn't bring the bill to the floor. And so it became much more user friendly. And so the point where we're at today is that not only do senators not have to actually go to the floor to wage a filibuster, they don't ever have to explain themselves. They can send an email to the cloakroom, and by that one email, the threshold for passing a bill gets raised to 60 votes. We've come to accept that as normal, and that's why it's sort of standardly accepted that it takes 60 votes to pass anything in the Senate, but that is not the way it was meant to be, and it's actually a very recent development of the past few decades that's even the case at all.
And the problem with this dynamic where you can wage a filibuster with the ease of basically, you know, getting a tee time, I guess, at a golf course, is that we just don't have we as in voters, as in constituents, don't have a sense of why certain bills aren't coming to a floor, the floor, or, you know, like we don't have a clear sense of who's advocating for what. Everything becomes much more opaque.
Right. I'm all for senators being able to delay a bill if they're going to go to the floor and explain themselves to the public. You know, that is in line with Madison's view of the Senate, that if it was supposed to provide a platform for persuasion. So if you were, you know, in the minority, if you were not, you know, if you were outnumbered when a bill came to the floor, you could go there and make your case. And if you could use your powers of persuasion to persuade people to come over to your side, you could win the day. But the point was, when that was over, if debate had been exhausted, the vote should come up and a majority should rule. Right now, we're having senators enable a minority to block everything that passes the Senate without ever having to even explain themselves. And so if they're going to want to block something, they should have to come to the floor. They should have to make their case. If they succeed, great, more power to them. If they fail, then the majority should rule.
Now, I know at the end of your book, you provide some suggestions for reform, but let's just truncate that. Should we get rid of, and at this point, under Harry Reid, I think, well, you served with him. He got rid of, in face of McConnell's really unprecedented obstruction of cabinet, members of judicial picks. He orchestrated the removal of essentially the filibuster, the killing of the filibuster for judicial picks and for cabinet members. McConnell subsequently did it with Supreme Court picks. Should we get rid of the filibuster for legislation as well? It's obviously not it's not something you can do unless you have at least 50 votes if you're Chuck Schumer. Would you recommend that, or should we just return to an era where the filibuster needs to be more mechanical, I guess?
I think that you should have reform that lowers the threshold to a majority. And there's different ways to do it. And you know, Senator Tom Harkin has had a proposal where you sort of ratchet it down over time, where after a certain number of hours of debate, say 5 to 10 hours of debate, the threshold goes down from 60 to 55, then eventually gets down to 50. So I have no problem with, you know, ideas like that, that keep the Senate to be a place where the minority will always have the ability to make their case and always have time to debate. But what has to happen is, as a standard matter of procedure, any bill that comes to the floor has to be able to arrive at a vote, a simple up or down vote, where it passes or fails. And so there's different ways to get there that I would support, but that has to be the end goal of reform. The reason is, if you flip it around, what you're doing by having a threshold of 60 is you're enabling a minority of as little as 41 senators who again could represent as little as 11% of the American population, you're giving them the power to block everything. And so the goal of reform has to be to take away the minority's power to block anything the majority wants to do. Because in our era of polarized politics, where one side succeeds by making the other side fail, the minority is not going to be able to resist the temptation to advance their political interests by making the party in power fail.
And in between that is make the minority that is obstructing legislation, make them pay some type of political price in terms of we need to justify this to the other 89% of the country as to why we're stopping this. So no $2,000 checks. Here's how why this is the case, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So, folks, I cannot recommend this book enough. To understand the dynamic between what people perceive as sort of dry parliamentary procedure and our actual politics that take place as well as policy. So, all right, let's talk about at this point. Let's talk about the what's going on now. I mean, obviously. We've got impeachment in the House. It may go to the Senate for a conviction. Give me your take on Mitch McConnell's private musings that he is happy about impeachment, which we all just happen to know.
Sorry about that. Yeah. It's his private musings that made their way into the New York Times. You know, I'm not sure what to make of this. I mean, I'm reminded, you know, in February of 2016, there was a very similar story that reported that Republicans were preparing to abandon Trump. And it cited McConnell specifically saying he was planning to drop Trump like a hot rock if Trump won the nomination. So I think that there may be a little bit of reputation rehabilitation going on here. McConnell trying to make clear that he doesn't like Trump. He might also be, you know, this might be a high fastball designed to keep Trump on his best behavior. After that video yesterday where Trump came out and said, you know, basically continuing to encourage violence. So this may be an attempt to make sure that Trump quietly leaves office on January 20th. If it's true that McConnell is actively considering voting to remove Trump and presumably bringing along the 17 senators he'd need to do so, I think you have to assume that that is because McConnell thinks it is in Republicans' interests to do so. He's been wanting to purge Trump from the party this whole time. I think, you know, what people often forget is that the Tea Party was causing McConnell fits long before Trump even came on the scene. You know, the rise of people like Ted Cruz, of Rand Paul, whom McConnell opposed in the Republican primary for Senate in 2010, these people were driving him crazy and forcing his hand and forcing him into a lot of uncomfortable positions before Trump came along. So for a long time, McConnell has wanted to get rid of this wing of the party. I'm not sure that he will follow through, because the reason he is not gone through with this sort of dramatic action in the past is that it would basically trigger a civil war, hopefully only figuratively, among the Republican Party. It may not yet be the case that it is better for Senate Republicans' political prospects to get rid of Trump. But if McConnell goes through with it, I think what we can safely assume is that McConnell has decided that it is in Senate Republicans' political interests to get rid of him.
Yeah, and I think your assessment is that is my sense as well. And we should also say that, you know, McConnell could think it's in the best interest of Republicans, and he could be wrong. Right. Like, he could miscalculate. And so I guess we'll have a better sense of that within the next 3 or 4 days. Good for Chuck Schumer, who I am generally very critical of, for basically calling McConnell's bluff. We'll see how explicit he does call McConnell's bluff on this, because this is all really about extracting a political price from the Republicans based upon what they do or do not do, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, look, I hope they vote to remove Trump from office. I would love to see him go out that way. But let's not give them too much credit here. We've spent 5 years of the Republican Party aiding and abetting Trump as he caused enormous damage to this nation and hurt countless people. So, you know, I hope they finally do the right thing, but it's about 4 years too late.
All right. So let's talk about this. And I think, you know, to a certain extent, I hope this audience at this point has a broad understanding of reconciliation. We're going to have three bites at the apple in terms of reconciliation over the next 2 years, because you're only allowed one reconciliation bill per fiscal year, and it was not used in this current fiscal year. So there'll be two other fiscal years where a reconciliation bill is there. It can only be stuff that deals directly with the budget, and you only need 50 plus one, really, I guess 51 votes to pass. But Joe Biden has just announced that he is not going to pursue reconciliation, or at the very least, he's going to pursue a bipartisan bill. Give me your sense of that.
Yeah. So you're right about reconciliation. It does provide a sort of end run around the filibuster. The downside of it is it has very tight restrictions on what can be included. I think when you talk about economic issues, there's a fair number of things that can be used to move through reconciliation. It does basically exclude any sort of democracy reforms and things like DC statehood, which I think are essential. So it could be used in the beginning to rush something through. It's a long, complicated story. You might end up having to go nuclear anyway if you use reconciliation, because if you run afoul of the rules, you're going to have to use the nuclear option to change them, even if you go through reconciliation. But it's a fine tool, you know, to use as a stopgap while you try to do other things. But I think fundamentally, civil rights, democracy reforms, and DC statehood will probably end up forcing the issue on filibuster reform. As you said, Biden has said he's going to at first try to bring a COVID relief package to the floor under regular procedures, not using reconciliation. So that means you need 60 votes, just like we've been talking about here. I guess he's optimistic that he can get those 60 votes. If he can, you know, the things that he's been talking about for the aid package sound great. It sounds robust. It's going to include $2,000 checks. If he can get 60 votes for that, more power to him. What I'm afraid of is that when they don't get 60 votes, that they will water down the package. And if they bring this package to the floor and they're unable to get 60 votes, they're going to face a decision point. And they can either decide to make the package weaker, or they can decide to reform the Senate rules and pass the stronger version of the package on a majority vote. That decision point could come very early on, and I hope the Biden administration doesn't choose to deliver a worse bill and less aid in deference to these antiquated Senate rules with this deeply racist history. I hope that they get rid of those rules, restore the Senate to the way it was supposed to be, and pass the strongest possible aid package for Americans who are really suffering right now.
All right. So you and I share the same aspirations, but I want to get a sense of what you think, how sincere is Joe Biden here? And we should say, as a backdrop to this conversation, and forgive me, I haven't quite matched up the timing, but I know at one point, Harry Reid, when we were looking at the fiscal cliff, I think it was must be maybe 2010, I think it was going into there, the Bush tax cuts were sunsetting. And there was essentially advantage and leverage on the Democratic side. Harry Reid wanted to basically call the bluff of the Republicans. The tax cuts were all going to expire, and Democrats could have brought up legislation that said, okay, now we're offering tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts are all gone. Now we're offering tax cuts. Instead, the Obama administration, and from what I understand, the reporting was Joe Biden sort of like slid in, undercut Harry Reid's plan, which was essentially undercutting the Democratic leverage, and made a deal with McConnell that essentially allowed them to pay no political price, allowed them to keep a lot of like the tax cuts they wanted, did not get the stuff that the Democrats wanted. With that history, and I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong on it.
Yeah.
What is your sense as to like, how much did they learn? How much did they want to learn from that? Is Joe Biden sincere, or is he just basically, this is what we have to do, from my education in the 90s, to pretend to, Chuck Todd, that we're actually going to try and be bipartisan?
Yeah, I mean, that Chuck Todd point is really it for me. I mean, you know, the senators have to decide if they're in office to please Chuck Todd and to get approval from the pundit class, or if they're there to deliver results for the people who sent them into office. I'm not sure where the Biden administration is going to come down yet. I'm not sure that they're sure. I think that they still think, you know, choosing neither is still an option, that they're going to be able to both deliver big results and do it in a bipartisan fashion. And they're welcome to try that, but I think they have to have a plan B that they're ready to shift into very quickly. If cooperation doesn't work, they have to decide that they're there to deliver results and meet the enormous challenges that we face as a country right now. The fiscal cliff example that you bring up still rankles with me. I was there at the time, and I remember, you know, you're right. Reid drove a hard bargain with McConnell. There was a point where McConnell decided he wasn't getting a good enough deal for Reid, so he went to Biden. And I remember standing in Reid's office at the moment the White House gave him the deal that they wanted Reid to cut. It gave away too much for Harry Reid. This was the winter time. There was a roaring fire in his fireplace in his office. He just turned to the side and threw the paper in the fire. So this was like, you know, my final answer is nothing. And I think Democrats have to be willing to take that kind of hard line against Republican obstruction. When Republicans fail to deliver on the things that we need, Democrats have to be ready to take the necessary steps to deliver those results themselves.
Okay, so let's say hope springs eternal. Joe Biden is doing this performatively. He knows that Mitch McConnell's not going to get the deal that they want and that the American public needs. But I'm going to do this. I'm going to make it. I'm going to placate whoever those voters are in Ohio who want a compromise and mythical ones, I would argue. He does that. And so then we're left with this idea of filibuster reform. How willing is it in your mind, and how much power does Joe Biden have to say, A, to Chuck Schumer, hey, look, this is pretty clear what we need here, and you're facing maybe a primary, so you have extra motivation to maybe do this, and I'm going to call Joe Manchin. And like, how much influence does Joe Biden have with Joe Manchin, or how much is it Joe Biden saying, like, Joe Manchin's there, I can't do anything, and so I'm going to have to give away the store to Mitch McConnell.
So Joe Biden has an enormous amount of power here, you know, and in some ways a unique amount of power, unique to him, because he has credibility on this issue with someone like Manchin, you know. And look, I look at this from the perspective of whipping votes, you know, which we had to do a lot in the leader's office. And, you know, I get that Manchin is firmly opposed. He's been very clear about that. But, you know, what you're talking about is a whip list of about, you know, 3 to 5 senators. So to me, I look at that and say, that's not a bad place to start. You know, you're not talking about a whip list of 15 to 20 people. So, you know, you can really focus your efforts on the people that you need to persuade. And Joe Biden, with his history of the Senate, you know, everybody knowing that this guy is about as deep as an institutionalist as they come. If he decides that reform is necessary, he is going to have unique credibility to go to someone like Joe Manchin and say, Joe, listen, you know me. I've tried everything. There is no other option here. We have to do reform. And I think that, you know, combined with other, you know, Manchin's issues, I think he's caught up in ideas of Senate history and reform that I think are incorrect. So I think, you know, helping explain the true origins of the filibuster, the fact that this was not the way it was supposed to be, you know, you combine those kinds of appeals with Joe Biden's unique credibility and persuasion. And I think you see a clear path to getting around to yes. It's going to take time. It's not going to happen right away. But if you only have a few senators standing in the way, I think that someone like Joe Biden is going to be able to persuade them if he chooses that that's what he wants to do.
Okay, so Joe Biden has this sort of like Nixon to China ability to talk to a Joe Manchin. Is it, when Joe Manchin says no to $2,000 checks, and then he did a quick 180 on that, good for him. But when he says no filibuster, is he doing that? Is it your sense that he's doing that because I'm a deep institutionalist and I this is hallowed ground and I don't want to change the filibuster? Or is he doing that because this is going to mean that maybe some bills get pushed through that aren't necessarily comport with what my donors and my sort of class of people want. And I want that filibuster so that we can't go too far.
Yeah, I think
center of the debate as well.
Right, right. I mean, that's the thing is the irony of this is that if you got rid of the filibuster and enable the Senate to pass things at a majority vote, Joe Manchin will be the most powerful senator in the Senate because you can't get anything passed unless you have his vote. You know, I think that that was not necessarily the case when it was possible the Democrats would control more than 50 seats. But I think now that things have settled where they are and you've got a direct 50-50 split with Vice President Harris breaking the tie, you know, Joe Manchin is empowered by this kind of reform. He can be the deal maker he wants. He can make sure that bills that he's uncomfortable with don't pass. You know, I'm not thrilled about that prospect as a liberal myself, but simply from an analysis of the power dynamics here, a majority rule Senate would put Joe Manchin in the catbird seat and enable him to be a total kingmaker on virtually everything that came to the floor. So I think those are the kind of appeals that over time will hopefully get him to yes.
So if I understand what you're saying is when Joe Manchin said months ago, I would be against the filibuster, he was not contemplating the notion of like, wait a second, I'm vote number 50. And I am literally the fulcrum of the Senate. And therefore, you know, I can get the Joe Manchin Stadium in West Virginia is going to look really good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, there's ways to get senators to yes. There's a lot more to his legacy than, you know, filibuster opposition. The other thing is, you know, the road to reform is paved with senators being on both sides of this issue. I mean, Harry Reid said he would never go nuclear. Chuck Schumer, you know, this is part of the, it's almost a rite of passage for senators to be on both sides of the issue. McConnell pushed to go nuclear and to deploy the filibuster reform when he was the second ranking member of the Republican Senate in 2005, when the Bush administration was making a hard push to deploy filibuster reform. So basically everybody's been on both sides of the issue. I hear what he's saying, but I don't see that as an insurmountable obstacle.
Okay. So lastly, let me ask you this. This notion, and we touched on it briefly, but this notion of the particularly this generation of Democrats that maintain the leadership in this party, their perception of who they must placate or whose judgment they must be in proper favor. The Beltway media, folks don't remember around here, but David Broder, that type of animal in Washington, that is, and I say David Broder, and people don't necessarily know who I'm talking about in this room, but that's indicative of maybe this is an era that is over. How much of a generational divide do you see within the context of the Senate, within the Democratic Party, about this particular notion of them having to address, I don't know, that we'd say the Chuck Todds, the Ledley Stahls, the Stephanopoulos, or whoever it is?
You have an entire generation of lawmakers coming up who've never spent a Sunday watching the Sunday shows. You know, I mean, and that's not, you know, due to their lack of engagement. They're incredibly engaged and informed, but the Sunday shows just don't set the agenda the way they used to. You have a huge generational divide here. And you look, Biden won the nomination. He won the election. But I think that's sort of papering over the fact that the rising generation of progressive lawmakers, they represent the future. This is an inexorable march of demographics, and they are the people who are going to take the lead in the next iteration of the party. So it is incredibly important with these reform conversations for everybody to know that they have an enormous amount of leverage here. Lawmakers have to listen to them, and they should make their voices clear.
Adam Gentleson, the book is Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. It's a fascinating read. I think it's incredibly important, particularly with a 50-50 Senate. I mean, these issues are going to have such an implication for people's lives on a just a material basis. Very important. Thanks so much for coming on. I would love to have you back to talk more as we see how this is going to plays out over the next month or two, actually.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back to wrap some stuff up. We are back. I want to apologize for some of the audio problems we were having during that segment. It is the Well, people go through this every day now in their daily lives. A lot of people do anyways, in terms of like school meetings or work meetings with Zoom and whatnot.
We've democratized the audio issue process.
That is right. That is right. All right, let's play this one clip. I mean, there is a lot of people who are feeling some regret, some of which is crocodile tears. And this is the important thing. I mean, let me just reiterate a couple of things that we heard with Adam Gentleson before we play this clip of Ken Langone. Mitch McConnell is sending up a trial balloon. One way or another, he's going to work in the best interest of the Republicans. That does not necessarily mean that just because he does A, that Democrats should do B. But just be aware that that dynamic is going on. Also, be aware that Joe Biden has a choice. He has a choice. He can try getting what he needs to get and have it a bipartisan bill. But if that doesn't work, he has a choice. Does he water it down or does he push for filibuster reform? You just heard a guy whose job it was to whip senators, literally whip, but get them to vote in a certain way. And he perceives this as not an insurmountable hill by any stretch of the imagination. He perceives Joe Biden uniquely well positioned to convince a Joe Manchin that we need filibuster reform. So understand, our politicians are making choices. How you respond to these things, and it's not to say that we all know who Joe Biden is, but we also know that people have a certain margin of potential in certain areas as politicians, and they are influenced by what their constituents say. And so you have to write them off. Pressure, sometimes you walk a tightrope with this type of pressure. But just be aware of these choices that our politicians are made. And I will also say, that doesn't go for just for politicians. It also goes for the billionaire class and the multimillionaire class who fund these political parties. For instance, Ken Langone, you know him maybe as a big financial supporter of Andrew Cuomo's, a big supporter of charter schools. In fact, almost single-handedly responsible for Andrew Cuomo's push for charters in this state. Well, he also was a big contributor to Donald Trump. Here he is talking to Andrew Ross Sorkin on CNBC.
My question to you is, what is your feeling about this today? And as I've asked others, including Mick Mulvaney, as somebody who supported this, do you feel like you enabled it to some degree?
I feel betrayed. Okay. Going through the court system to try and get some results, he exhausted everything. It was over. Biden's the president. Biden should be in the White House. And I'll give you a very simple thing, Andrew. I think the biggest mistake anybody can make is to offer mitigating reasons why what happened last Wednesday was a disgrace and should never have happened in this country. And if it doesn't break every American's heart, something's wrong. It breaks my heart, for sure. I didn't sign up for that. And more importantly, I think right now all of us have one. To me, I'm speaking for myself, I'm going to do everything I can from day one to make sure I do my part to make Joe Biden the most successful president in the history of the country. And there's a selfish reason for that. We've got very serious, major issues in America to deal with. We've got the pandemic. We've got the debt. We've got infrastructure. We have a horrendous condition of public schools in America. We have generational theft. What the hell is a guy like me doing getting money from the government every month?
Okay. Right. Well, we can rest easy knowing that Ken Langone, the man whose greed has warped him to the point where he's so removed from the consequences of his political donations that he doesn't think that he's in any way responsible for enabling a guy like Trump, which created that yesterday.
Of course.
Like,
that's like I bought a ticket for the roller coaster, but I only got it for the parts that went up, not down. But let me just go through quickly the list that he's talking about. When he says public education, he's talking about he wants to push charters. When he's talking about debt, he wants to cut Social Security. He said it right there. Why am I getting a government check every month? I'll tell you why. Because it's much easier for the government, much less costly for the government, to give everybody a Social Security check and take it back in your taxes. If you want means testing for Social Security, we take more back in taxes. He knows this. This is a guy who's making a pivot. understand what you're seeing in this moment, folks. There's a lot of people who are going to be jumping off a sinking ship, and they're going to make it like they're doing so willingly, not because they're afraid of getting sucked down to the bottom of the ocean. Be very, very skeptical. We will see you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we will see you like
we
right
now.
We are
seeing you. Yeah.
We see you. We see you.
We actually are looking at all of you. We have that technology here.
We didn't want to reveal that.
Right. Well,
we didn't want to say
because it makes us look
like peeping toms.
Like sellouts or hypocrites.
Peeping toms. I would say a little bit like that. Folks, we got a lot to cover. I don't know where we are. Madam. Madam. Matt.
Madam. Madam.
Madam. Madam. Speaker. Where are we in terms of the impeachment? Do we know? Brendan? Matt?
Let's see.
Let's take a break.
This live coverage from the house, so they're still in the house.
All right, we'll figure it out.
We will take a break, head to the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, I wanted to plug these. I have in the past. This is the mask I've been wearing lately. It's an excellent mask. Looks great.
I know. He tried to talk to me with it yesterday on. Can't understand a word he's saying.
It's actually really
but
good.
But it seems good.
Really good with my glasses, too, which is a big issue for me. It's got gauze sewn
wow.
into it. Yes. And it comes – you can buy very chic-looking pouch for it that you can clip on or you
what
can wear
it?
A lanyard. It's called – it comes in colors. It is, you can go to comesincolors.com, buy the masks and the clips that comes in, obviously, many
is that
different
a Rolling
colors.
Stones reference?
No, actually, it's a different song. I know that's from the Rolling Stones song, but it's a, okay. even a different song. I can't remember what Love Potion or something like that. I'm not sure. But check it out. comesincolors.com, folks. A friend of mine is making these masks and... and they are donating a certain percentage to, I can't remember what charity is, but they do. She does a lot.
It's really
charity.
A nice mask. I've noticed it looks like, you know, it blocks. It's
oh,
like
no,
sturdy,
I mean, it's very sturdy and yeah. it's just, it's comfortable. And it's stylish. There's a lot of stylish masks there. So check that out. Also, don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. And you get bonus material virtually every single day. Don't forget, too, we got merch. We will, we're going to roll out a couple of new products in the merch store. That's very, very exciting. Shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, amquickie.com. Check it out and get your 7 minutes of headline news every morning. We're getting it out super early these days, like sometimes prior to 7 a.m.
Wow. When do you sleep?
Well, it's not me who cuts it. I just do it late at night sometimes.
Oh, but, really?
I mean, I record it. I don't cut it. Dorsey cuts it.
No, I know. I thought you recorded it very, very early in the
sometimes
morning.
Sometimes we do it that way, too. It depends on what's going on with the news. But check it out, amquickie.com. Also, today, my phone fell, so I don't know who's on Nomi's show today. But... check out youtube.com/the Noma Keys show. You can.
Deborah Levitt, Simon Narode, and Jordan Zakarin. Good job pronouncing things.
There you go. Yes, yep. Check it out. Patreon.com/the Noma Keys show or youtube.com/the Noma Keys show. And of course, the Antifada, they're doing Twitch streams like three nights a week now.
Wow.
Twitch.tv/TheAntifada. Check that out. Always good stuff. Matt, last night was the TMBS, the tribute to Michael, his comedic chops.
Yep, the comedy panel that went live on the TMBS YouTube page last night. And tomorrow night we'll be having a TMBS regular, Daniel Bessner, on to talk about Biden's foreign policy and probably some of his domestic counterterrorism stuff as well. So that's tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Left Reckoning's YouTube page.
All right, folks, quick break. Fun half. And listen, reminder, if you want to IM the show, just pick up the app, majorityapp.com.
Sorry, iOS. I was gonna sneeze.
Oh, iOS and Android. Majorityapp.com. You can IM the show during the fun half, which is about to happen right now. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
Dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's a good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.